This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie. This podcast was recorded at the second Dublin Anarchist Book Fair, the 3rd of March 2007. The title of this session was The Rise of the Left in South America, and there were three speakers on different aspects of that, followed by a discussion of about 20 minutes.
Okay, this session is on the rise of the left in South America, and in fact also North America, as things were also talking about Mexico. We're going to have three talks. Pepe is going to start, he's from Chile, he's going to sort of give a general introduction and overview. And then Brenda is going to talk about Mexico and what's happening in Mexico. And then Victor will talk for a while about what's happening in Colombia. That'll be about maybe half an hour altogether, and then we'll have half an hour for a discussion and questions. So, Pepe,
if you want to... Yes. Well, we're invited for... That's a very good thing Andrew's saying, that the talk is not actually about the rise of the left in South America, because it's actually a rise of the left in all of Latin America. That includes Central America and parts of North America, though still we have a discussion if Mexico is really North America or not, because for us it was always Central America. That's what we were told, yeah. You know? And suddenly there came the North America Free Trade Agreement, the NAFTA, back in 1994, and suddenly they became North America. But up to that stage, we thought they were Central America. Probably according to Washington, we were wrong. We don't know. But we might be as well. Anyway, it's all about Latin America. There are many facts and figures going around what's happening in South America in terms of the economic crisis, in terms of the new left-wing president, in terms of a number of things. But the main distinction we want to do is that there's a double process in Latin America. On the one hand, you know, you have certainly a process of radicalization of the politics in Latin America, but at the same time, and probably because of that process of radicalization, you have a process as well of a strong shift to the right of a lot of the former left. And that process is seriously ignored in the mainstream European papers. I mean, I remember when I was reading about the last Chilean elections, when Michelle Bachelet was elected as a president, everyone was saying, oh no, you have another socialist president in Chile. Well, we've actually had socialist governments since 1990. So, in theory, there's nothing new. But then again, you know, the impression of a socialist government, again, in Chile, you know, sort of making the comparisons with Allende's time and all that is completely inaccurate. Because socialists now are not the same socialists that were in 1970. I mean, in the meantime, there was a coup, in the meantime, there was a savage repression, and in the meantime, all the leaders were sent to Europe, to France, to Italy, to study, and they became knowledgeable of Eurocommunism, and then when they came back, they were a completely different story, you know? Pretty much, I would say the Socialist Party in Chile is, by all they do, is a very hardcore right-wing party. They were the ones pushing for free trade agreement, a number of things. So that's a good example to start asking, well, we talk about the rise of the left in Latin America, but how of that is substantial and how of that is fictitious? You know, the understanding of that, it's useful to the extent that it allows us to see where does a revolutionary change can happen or how it can develop. So let's say first that this process of radicalization of the popular movement, I'm going to start addressing the popular movement, has two main components. The first one is the accumulation of experience and of struggles by the very people by themselves. You know, there's a long tradition in Latin America of popular struggle that includes peasants, that includes indigenous peoples, that includes women's movements, that include trade unions, that include the people at large, you know, the underdog, the dispossessed, the whatever you want to call it, you know, the working class. You have a long process of struggles that you can even trace back to the years of the conquest. So you have a 500 years time of accumulation of experience, you know, and all that comes to be expressed in the recent recent upheavals and riots, and insurrections and protests and demonstrations, as they have been expressed as well back in the 60s and back in the 50s and back in the 30s. There's always a process of accumulation. People have a very long memory in Latin America. There's a really, really long memory. And probably one of the main examples of that is that I was now last May, I was in La Paz, It was a very nice time to be in La Paz as well, because Evo Morales at the time was nationalizing the gas. So there was a lot of things going on at the time. And you could see the miners in the streets marching, you know, they would say, "Hi, I don't want to insult you. Hi, 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 Tupac Katari. Hi, hi, hi." Tupac Katari was a leader of an indigenous revolt back in 1780. So they were still saying, "Give it hooray for a man from 1780. You know, that's what I mean when I'm talking about a long social memory, you know. But then you have more recent experience, and you have a history of development of socialist movements for the last 120 years that have been quite radical, that have all the single currents that you can think in the world were expressed in Latin America. You know, pro-Albanians, they exist in Latin America. Anarchists, they exist in Latin America. Pro-Chinese, they existed. Any single current you can think in the world, it was present there. And they all left a mark in one extent or another. You know, and at the same time, you have a very long tradition of autonomous organization in the South Side Trade Union, a very strong grassroots movement. But at the same time, this movement could be expressed, you know, thanks to a number of, because of some very unfortunate conditions that struck all of Latin America throughout the mid of the 90s. There was developed back in the days in the 60s a theory to explain imperialism and to explain the backwardness of Latin America. It was called the theory of dependence. Hugo Facio, Faleto, they all were into that theory. Some famous economists at the time, Cardoso, that was became later president of Brazil, was one of the leftists that were behind that theory. And what they say was basically saying that Latin America lacked, the problem of Latin America was not development. Up to that stage, everyone said, "Oh, the problem of Latin America is underdevelopment, we have to develop Latin America, and when it's developed, it's going to be just like Europe." And they said, no, the problem of Latin America is not development. Actually, we've been developing in a capitalist way as well. But the thing is, we are at the other side of the sea, and our development has meant an increased vulnerability. Our development has meant a shift from sustainable economies to monoproduction and to supply of cheap labor. So the problem is not that, it's dependence. So dependence means the lack of an internal input for our economies. So then we get to the root of the matter of what happened in the 90s. From there on, there was start to appear the first signs of exhaustion of the neoliberal model. And the central economies always tend to pass the crisis, the economic crisis, to the peripheral economies. And that's possible because peripheral economies don't have an internal input, so they're much more vulnerable. And therefore, it meant that the things like the coordinated recession that happened between the years 2001 and 2002 in the States and Europe, mainly in the States, I don't know if you remember the case of Enron and WorldCom back in 2001, just before the Twin Towers, you know, all that recession was recovered by passing the crisis to South America. And it's not a coincidence that at the time, you know, it's the time of all the social movements that topple governments in Ecuador, Mawal, in Bolivia, Goni, Sánchez de Lozada, in Argentina, you have De La Rúa, 2001, there was a seminal case of the crisis being passed to South America. And you have to explain those situations of political instability from this double perspective. On the one hand, the economic crisis, but on the other hand, the experience of the people. So the experience of people made sense at this point when the situation crumbles. But then again, what's interesting is that in this new what's it called? Coyuntura in English. Jesus Christ. Contingency. Contingency. Yes, did you say that right? This new contingency. No.
Context.
Yeah, well. In this new context, you know, that is marked by a very strong recession. So you have at least two ones that are very, very big. 94 in Mexico, El Efecto Tequila. And then you have 99, El Efecto Caipirinha in Brazil. You have the appearance of new social actors. And I think that's very interesting to understand why the social actors come to emerge, you know? And basically, the two main social actors that appear in South American politics with definite characteristics are, on one hand, the middle classes, and on the other hand, the indigenous movement. The indigenous movement, though being present from early times in the conquest, you know, by all the colonial system that basically was what we call a pigmentocracy, you know, a society where whites were at the top, then mulattoes, then Indians, then Zambos, then black, or whatever. And this arrangement changed from country to country. In Chile, for instance, the blacks were above the Indians, but in Colombia, the blacks were below the Indians. So it varied from place to place. But your belonging to a certain ethnic group always marked your position socially, you know? And that wasn't different. It actually depended on the economic system, because blacks were slaves and Indians were serfs. So that was the reason behind it. It wasn't because Indians were superiors or whatever, you know, there was anything in the color of the blacks that made them ideal to be slaves. It was all part of a much bigger social context. But Indians being a very definite actor, you know, from those days, during the 20th century, they were all absorbed in the peasant movement. And when you look at South America, probably Mexico is a bit different, but if you look at South America during the 60s, the 70s, agrarian struggles, you will seldom see Indians, though they were all Indians, you know, but they were referred to as peasants. And that's for one reason. It's because at the time, you know, the Communist Party was very big, and that's the way they defined the social actors of struggle in Latin America. You have workers, you have middle classes, and you have peasants. And the peasants didn't matter really their whatever national identity or whatever. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union and with the loss of importance of the Communist Party in defining the politics in Latin America, there emerges this new actor. Another important point is 92, when it's the 500 year of the anniversary of the discovery of America. And people start thinking again, you know, well, actually, what we're celebrating? Do we have anything to celebrate? Do we have anything to commemorate? What happened? All those reasons led to a resurgence of the indigenous movement. And the indigenous movement moved from the demand from land to the demand for territory. It's completely different. It's land plus the possibility of developing their culture, plus an idea of social empowerment, political empowerment. So Indians appear in the Latin American scenario somehow, and they leave definitely a mark, because they shift as well politics in a number of ways. There's not only a criticism now to this or that form of capitalism, but the Indians have been very radical in criticizing the system as a whole, politically, institutionally, and well, a number of interesting things that have came up out from that. Many of the indigenous leaders from today come from the left as well. So there is a process as well of breaking from some of the former conceptions they had. And in relation to the middle classes, they have to be understood, they have a particular importance in two of the South American big upheavals. Argentina, but it's not surprising, because all the economic collapse was given by the collapse of the banking system. So it was basically first people protesting that they were losing their accounts. So obviously the middle class was at the forefront of that. And in Ecuador as well. And in Ecuador, the hegemony of the middle classes was possible for two main reasons. First, because of the relative weakness of the working class. We have to acknowledge that 3 minutes. We have to acknowledge that with the enormous impact of neoliberalism over the last 20 years, the old trade union movement is down. The levels of organization are absolutely minimum. In Chile, I don't know in other places, but in Chile at least, the 7% of the working class is trade unionized. That shows that it's a non-existent actor as such, you know, anymore. And there's a lot of precarity, high levels of unemployment. So that meant that the working class as such, as we knew it, you know, it's been in a very weak position to take the lead in many of the struggles, you know. So that allowed, in the case of Argentina and Ecuador in particular, middle classes to take the lead. Middle classes, we mean professionals, we mean people with liberal professions, you know. That's in particular what we mean, because middle class is always a very difficult to define term. So they are allowed to appear. But then we have when this movement takes the lead, there's always the people come always behind, the people at large, the working classes, you know, in the disorganized fashion, and with their spontaneity, they start doing factory occupations, like in Argentina, they start putting popular assemblies here and there, and there's always the Latin insurrection in South America has been marked by this sort of conflict between the two interests, you know, the middle class, without having any historical input themselves, being very cautious of the turn of things and trying to get things down. No, we just want to take the government down, you know. That's what their position was in Argentina, in Bolivia, in Ecuador. But don't take it too far. But other people say, no, we actually want to change sides, we want something different. So the lack as well, because of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the hegemony that the Communist Party used to have, there was a lack as well of a political program given by the working class to the crisis of the crisis. With the effect that in all of those countries after the fall of the former president, there's been a recomposition of the old ruling class, of capitalism, and we haven't got much further. But we have a bit more of experience, again, in this process of accumulating experience after what we've done. But experience on its own is not enough. You need to think about it, and you have to turn it into a revolutionary change, into a program. So next time that there's a situation like that, you can actually get a bit further than changing this or that president. So this is the situation among the people. Very briefly, very schematical. Hopefully you make questions, because I'm leaving a lot of things out. But then on the other hand, you have that there's been some leaders coming to some international prominence from the left, becoming leaders of heads of state. You have in Rafael Correa in Ecuador, you have Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, you have López Obrador in Mexico, you have Tabaré Vázquez in Uruguay, you have Néstor Kirchner in Argentina, you have in Brazil Lula, and you have in Chile, well, Michelle Bachelet. Well, as I said, though there's been a turn, definitely turned to the left by the bulk of the people, you know, I mean, there's an increasing sense of dissatisfaction, not only with neoliberalism, but with capitalism in general. You can feel it, you can sense it. I was back at home last year, you can really feel it. I'm finishing in 1 minute. Definitely, the leaders, it's a lot to say, really. Definitely, the leaders have been turning to the right. And their accession to power has been possible because of the weakness of the ruling classes, you know? And on the other hand, by the increase in pressure from below. So their sole accession to power is indicating that people don't believe in the traditional ruling class, but at the same time, they've been able to access power because they've been, to a certain extent, allowed by the United States. As long as they shift to the right, and I remember when Evo Morales won the elections, Otto something, I have a German name, but he was from the State Department in the United States, said, we have no problem with leftist government, as long as they're reasonable. So you have to read that saying, we have no problem if you came to be of the left, as long as you don't behave like lefty, you know? And that's exactly what's been going on. They're all been shifting to the right. Evo Morales came to power by saying that he was going to nationalize gas, and I remember I was there in May in Bolivia, it was in April too, and he was saying, no, just 51% of the royalties will go to the Bolivian situation. I don't know how they were. I mean, he would have been top if he didn't. And it was the popular pressure that forced him to go like, no, we'll nationalize, you know? But in other parts, it's not that much of a popular pressure like in Bolivia, because they have a huge history of organizing, very well organized people. In Nicaragua now we have Daniel Ortega pushing free trade agreement. Same thing that happened in Chile with Michelle Bachelet. Tabaré Vázquez now in Uruguay. You have Lula and Kirchner from Argentina, not only denying everything they said beforehand and moving from radical Trotskyism in the case of Lula from the early 80s to a very mild version of any other, really, of this new left rock stars of South America. And you have all of them as well taking part for the first time, and this is very interesting to acknowledge, taking part for the first time in an armed intervention from one South American country to another South American country in imperialist terms, that is Haiti. You have Uruguayan, Argentinian, Brazilian, Chilean, and Bolivian armies intervening in Haiti. For what? For imperialist interest. If you want to do questions about Haiti, we can talk about it, because it's a very interesting case to know how imperialism is working today in Latin America when they're stuck in the Middle East and cannot commit troops. So they're using, for the first time, local troops as mercenary troops. So that's the situation there. The only one of the South American leaders that has been systematically moving to the left is Chavez.
Wow.
That's the only one that's been systematically moving to the left, starting from a sort of central position, moving more and more to the left. still insufficient, still not revolutionary, still a state, however you want to put it, but it's been moving to the left. It's the only one that you can say that. All the others have massively turned to the right.
Okay, thanks Pepe. Now Brenda's going to talk about the situation in Mexico.
Yes, well, thank you for coming, and I'm going to ask you to also help people with fancy words, because I can't, something like, coyuntura is really hard, and I know sometimes, you know, this can be hard to translate some terms, and it could be difficult. If you have any questions, let's make this a chat, and also help me in talking about Mexico. I don't only talk about Mexico because I'm afraid to generalize some of the things that are going on. I'll start by saying basically that if you want to understand the left, or the left in Mexico at the moment, and I'm not talking about the official left, the one that is on the ballots and on presidential campaigns, I'm talking about the left that is being built from the bottom. The only way to understand this left in Mexico is if you see Mexico with an agrarian crisis that have lasted for 500 years since the arrival of Spanish people, and the disintegration of the native economy and the implantation of a foreign economy through expropriation of land. These 500 years in Mexico have made a lot of population, native populations, go farther and farther away from, let's call it civilization, in the mountains, the forest, and they've been living there for 500 years in the same way they've been living before the arrival of the Spanish. So they were forgotten, basically, by history, or the official history. Mexico is a new country, basically. On 1810, it was the independence from the Spaniards. The consolidation of the Mexican state was on the revolutionary period in 1910. It's when the Mexican state is really consolidated as a secular state. And all these Indians that were living there in the jungle, in the forest, or whatever, basically they've been always present on the thinking and the building of the state in some way. And we need to think about, for instance, the Flores Magón during the revolution, and Zapata, obviously, Pancho Villa. And that way we see that the new constitution, the constitution that made the modern Mexico after the revolution, included some really interesting laws, like, for instance, the agrarian reform, which is one of the basic ones, secular and free education, that would be basically one of the, and well, some workers' rights, but basically what we need to think about Mexico is that it's mostly an agrarian country with people trying to recover the land that were taken from them. After the revolution, then basically, in the context of the two world wars, the Mexican state was consolidated after the revolution, and we could actually nationalize oil, electricity, and roads, and lots of all of this. But mainly, what we need to think basically is about the oil and the electricity. The agrarian reform never was implemented on the paper, but it was never implemented actually in action. It was easy to actually write it on the constitution and say, well, yes, the people have the right to have their lands, their territories, but it never arrived, for instance, to be implemented in places like Chiapas. And we wouldn't be able to understand the Zapatista movement after the revolution if we don't actually know that this agrarian reform never had access to it. Yucatan, Guerrero, basically the south of Mexico, the most Indian Mexico. The agrarian reform was done in the north, near the U.S. border, and the center also, the most Spanish one, to call it one way. So it's 500 years of resistance and the ideas that have been have been feeding the feedback to from reaching the Constitution of Mexico. In the 80s, in 1982, basically, we had, after the revolution, the party in power. It was the Institutional Revolutionary Party that lasted for almost 80 years, 79 years, that worked basically as a corporation. Everything was state-owned, and it was the welfare state, father of all the good Mexicans, giving them lands, and all the wealth was administered by the state. And that's the reason why we could actually see this party lasting so long in Mexico, because basically everybody was part of it in a way. Everybody was part of the state. In 1982, basically, there is a shift inside the institutional party, and a new generation of administrations, basically educated in Harvard, took over the party. And they're basically what we call technocracy. They are the ones that basically came with all these ideas of the Austrian School of Economics, and how to develop the country. We needed to basically let private investment to go into oil, education, roads, private lands. And so within the party in the 1982, the institutional party, everything started to be solved, and the Mexican state started to be disintegrated. Until we reached the date of 1992, when Mexico signs the NAFTA agreement with the US. And the only way to put it is like if you visualize a plane full with bombs, and you systematically target every single factory and industry in Mexico and bomb it. That's the result of NAFTA in Mexico after since 1992 to this date. Leaving basically what it is in the last presidential period in Mexico, the Fox one, almost 2 million Mexicans left Mexico and went to work to the US, and almost 300 Mexicans lost their lives trying to cross the border. That's the, let's call it the sad part of it, the sad side of it. In 1992, we also have that the Zapatista movement come into public light, taking over the village, San Cristóbal de las Casas. There is a wake-up call, especially after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. There was no really a choice between 1989 and 1992 in Mexico. People felt like there was really any choice, like there was no left, that there was no choice but to go with the trend and sign the NAFTA agreement, because the other option didn't work at all. But when we had the Zapatista, the Ejército Zapatista coming in 1992, and basically, in 1992. 94? Yeah. It's the beginning. Well, basically, what I would like to point out after this is that the first period of the Zapatismo is basically very light, very politically correct, fighting for the right of the Indians, the right to have their lands back, the respect to their ways of living. And it's common sense to go there and support their struggle, and that's why they can gather a lot of consent on the civil population in Mexico, and they are actually very wise in kind of marketing their struggle. They will have the internet, and they have a web page, and they really can use and know how to use these tools in their advantage. They disappear into the public light. We don't really know much about them. Sometimes we hear it with a community is being under siege or things like that. Not really like before, when Marcus used to talk and reporters used to follow him all around, and there were pictures of him all over and t-shirts and whatever. We for we don't really know anything about them until the election campaign, the last election campaign in 2006, when they come actually with the sixth declaration of the Latin jungle, and where they actually open a new era for them. Like, they're not only talking about Indians' rights or native rights, they are actually telling to the people, well, this is what we come from. For many, many 12 years we've been building up our communities, self-managing our schools, self-managing our clinics, and through all this experience, basically, we've come to realize that the option for us, we've learned to that the real problem for us is basically not the Mexican government, it's not the Mexican state. The problem for us, we won't get to resolve our real problems unless we basically end with this system, and that system is the capitalism. And then they define themselves as being anti-capitalist. And I think that's very important for the left in Mexico, because at the time there was a presidential election where a so-called left was contending with extreme right that actually won through a fraud, and with the party, the institutional party that was in power for 8 years. And then they define themselves in difference with this so-called left that was contending, and they say, we are the left, we want to build a new left from the bottom, and this left has to be anti, well, not has to be, because they actually, well, we believe in that we can't be authoritarians like the traditional parties can be. We believe that we need to make a pacific struggle, because that's the only way people can defend themselves, because otherwise they are trapped in the middle, like in Colombia, for instance, between the army, paramilitaries, and the guerrilla army. We don't believe that's an option for us. We want to build on pacific terms the change from the bottom to the left. And then they call this the other campaign, and the call is to network, and it's an national and international call to all groups that define themselves also as anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarians, and that believe in self-management and all this, that basically we can do things from ourselves. So this happened in 2006, and basically to end, what I would like to talk about is what happened in Atenco. A lot of organizations and people then adhere to this sixth declaration and this other campaign. And they, one of these is the Front of the People in Defense of the Land. In 2002, basically Mexico, what is the great project to modernize Mexico is the Plan Puebla Panama. It's going all the way from Mexico then now to Central America, from North America to Central America, and to, basically, it's one of the main projects. One of the main projects to implement this was to build an airport 20 miles away from Mexico City. And in order to do so, they needed to expropriate the land of the farmers there. And people didn't accept that. It's very much the similar world what Shell is doing here. They tried to do that, and people didn't accept that, and so Fox, who was the president at the time, had to retrieve that expropriation order. And from this experience then, the Front of the People in Defense of the Land came into light, public light, and they are part of the other campaign. And no, you see, I'm looking at this. And we can see through this the level of organization that in Mexico, the people in Mexico are achieving, but also the level of repression and brutality from the government is equalizing this level of organization. On the 3rd of May, basically almost, I think it was 30,000. I'm really bad with numbers. I'm really sorry, as you can see. But there was a big repression, a massive repression. One of the statements of the other campaign is that if they hit one of us, they hit all of us. At the time, there was a Zapatista commission touring on the autumn campaign in Mexico City, which is only half an hour away from where this happened. And a lot of people went there and tried to stop the army from taking over the Atenco, the small village. And people were brutally and savagely beaten up, taken into high prison securities. 47 of the women who were taken with them were raped or sexually abused. And but still, other thing that I would wanted to point out is that we don't actually believe in, or the other campaign don't believe in leaders, and the Front of the People in Defense of the Land and the Assembly of the People in Oaxaca are two clear examples of on how this is working and how this is being organized. Basically, they took in jail one of the, they called them leaders, Ignacio del Valle. He's still in jail, but the Front has not been disintegrated because the Front is the people, the Front is the village. So even if they take over people in jail, the movement is still there, and the assemblies are still being held, and the people then designate another speaker to speak for themselves in public, but the decisions are still being made. In June of this year, in Oaxaca, one of the, in the south, one of the, Oaxaca is one of the poorest states in Mexico, along with Chiapas and Guerrero. There was a teachers' movement. Every year, the teachers, all, we need to remember that education is state-owned, that the state sponsored. It should be free. But since 1982, this has been trying to disintegrate this public system of education. And the teachers are forced to take over the streets and demand a salary raise every year. In this context of the presidential elections, the other campaign, the teacher, it came time, it was the time of the year where the teachers had to take over the street and demand a salary rise. And what happened is that the governor of Oaxaca was Apriista from the institutional party. The institutional party, from being the leader, the party in power for 80 years, became the third force contending in the elections. It was crucial for the extreme right to get the support of the PRI in order to ensure that they could take over the presidency. And in order to ensure this support, they needed to maintain key governors in several states in Mexico, and Oaxaca was one of them. So the people, when the teachers asked for their salary rise, the governor, feeling this empowerment that he was all powerful and whatever, refused to deal with the teachers and sent the state army and took them off the square brutally. And 3 days after this happened, the assembly of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca was formed with more than 360 organizations, and again, they were forced, like, self-managing themselves. They took over the city, they took over the municipalities, they took over the radio stations, television stations, and started to broadcast whatever it was going on, and speeches, music, and the demand initially was very basic. We want a salary raise, we want the people who beat us to be punished, and we want Ulises Ruiz, the governor, out. But we need to remember that the Ulises Ruiz, the governor of the PRI, could not be out because the election was there, and if they took out that governor, the PAN could not take over the presidency, and it lasted for months. And for months and for months, these people at the main square in the city were harassed. Army sent over to them, they replied themselves and then took over the square again until the 25th of November. The Federal Army took over the main square and the people had to look for refuge at the State University, and they stayed for there for a while. But the people who were taken over were tortured, sent to high security prisons. 15 of the detainees, male detainees this time, were raped. But still, the assembly is there. The so-called leader, Flavio Sosa, was taken into jail last year in November also. But the assembly held a recent reunion, and they came up with amazing things like how ways to fortify themselves, the struggle to free the prisoners, how to build an state assembly look for an alternative government, self-management, a new constitution. And the reference are not only the other campaign, the Zapatista other campaign, but also the National Democratic Convention, which there was a movement also that came out of the fraud in July, because the extreme right took over the there was a fraud, a cybernetic fraud. I don't know how it worked, because it was algorithmic. I don't know anything about numbers, but apparently it was proven that there was a fraud. López Obrador could not take the presidency, and these people that believed on the electoral system, and that there's still voting is still an option, took over the main. It's like O'Connell Street, the equivalent of O'Connell Street. They were there for 2 months, I think. And they actually organized what is called the National Democratic Convention. And that's still going on, but that's more like the soft left, this kind of soft dictatorships through democratic discourse that are all over the place now in Latin America. So at the time we have this new right, so we have the other campaign, we have the assemblies, where the assembly, the Popular Assembly of the People of Mexico was formed on the 19th of November with 19 state assemblies, and that's quite new, so we still don't know what's going on, what is going to happen with that. Hopefully, as some of the analysts think, this is one of the darkest periods in Mexican history, and we have quite a few. But it's also a period where a lot of hope and new exercise on representative democracy and a left from the bottom. So.
Thanks. I know we're going way over time in terms of speakers, but I think they're very interesting, so there'll be less time for questions at the end. Sorry. Victor, you're going to tell us
thanks. Thanks
a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. I hope it's as interesting as their talks. Basically, I'm taking over a little bit on the indigenous movement, and I'm going to talk also about Colombia. A bit disappointing, I'm not from Colombia myself, but I've been helping out a group of Colombian people together with Pepe as well, in coordination with the LASC, Latin America Solidarity Center. And basically we've been trying to make aware people about this problem where indigenous people are, like Brenda was saying before also, trapped in the middle of this like civil war in Colombia, where we have the different actors like the paramilitaries, the guerrilla, the army themselves, the government, and how they've been affected not only by this kind of civil war, but also just other projects like in the Sierra Nevada in the north of Colombia. They want to build this massive dams, and they also want to build trains going up to the mountains to visit ruins, things like that. Like, they call it ecotourism, but it's nothing like that. So all these indigenous people are against all these projects, and they want their lands for themselves, right? So basically, I'm talking about experience. Like, this group, like, we've been volunteering and trying to make people aware about this, okay? For the last maybe year and a half, collecting signatures. We've been talking to Minister of Foreign Affairs, Adrian Fitzgerald, about this issue and how the Irish government can help the European Union to to fund all these projects, because they gave some money to the Colombian government, okay, and they use it for other purposes. The money is supposed to be used for demobilizing. It's not an easy word again. Demobilizing the paramilitaries from the mountain. So they want basically to disarm these armed forces, and they want to integrate them back into civil life. Yeah, I'm going to talk about, in general, about the paramilitaries. They came into existence back in the 80s, right? Basically, they were, like I said, armed groups working to fight against the guerrillas. The guerrillas were operating in the mountains again, and there were groups protecting small villages, small growers. They were more like the Marxist left side, okay? The paramilitaries came into place on the other side, like helping the big landowners, like I said, in the 80s. And little by little, they realized they could make loads of money in the drug business, like cocaine, basically. We've all heard about this big issue in Colombia, right? So there were supposed to be around 25,000 people, just the paramilitary groups. And like I said, they were controlling vast areas, okay? And they eventually grow coca to produce cocaine. Then back in 2003, the main group is the AUC, is the Autodefensa Unidas de Colombia, something like the Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, began talks with the current government, what has been in the same government for the last 8 years, maybe, by now, six? Yeah, so 6-7 years. Uribe, who is the president now in Colombia. This is a bit disappointing again, okay, because Colombia is not an example of left in South America, but that's why we're talking about it, okay. And, Uribe, like I said, held these talks with the paramilitary groups and basically wanted to show the world that they were doing something about it, and they were disarming these people and reintegrating them into society. But instead, this became it's like a fake demobilization process. And they have also this the so-called law and justice agreements, whereby these paramilitaries they were given the option to disarm and become part of the civil society, right? But and they were given money from the government, so and also like courses, training, so that because they've been doing the same thing all their lives, like training for war, basically. So it's not easy to get 25,000 people back into civil life. The thing is, the law and justice agreements became more like a way to gain impunity for these paramilitary groups, because at the same time, while they become part of the civil society, they get this impunity where they're not judged. So from the main Colombian people, This is seen as very, very unfair, as you can imagine, because there's a lot of crimes behind them, behind all these paramilitaries. And from about 23,000 of them that are supposed to be demobilized, it's believed thousands of them are still involved in gun crimes and extortion through different ways, like they sell this security to people, and they get money from them, and they sell security from the guerrilla. So they're still involved in this extortion and kind of war. Again, in the middle of everything, They have nothing to do with it. It's the indigenous people of Colombia. In several places, like in the north and other historically indigenous sites. Last, I just want to say again, we are little by little becoming a group more concerned about what's going on in not only in Colombia but in Latin America. And we are in the process now of creating like a website where we can express our ideas and think over what's going on in Latin America. And it's gonna, we're thinking about names at the moment, like something like Roots, Raíces. And so if you want to get involved or if you want to know more about it, we can talk. I mean, you can come over and talk to one of us. Pepe is involved, and like I said, we have 3-4 other Colombian nationals also. One of them was supposed to talk today. And that's it. For the last 2 years, there's been also visits from people from Colombia, some Cancuamo leaders, indigenous. We have also Mapuche from indigenous people from Chile, Juana Calfunao, who is a great example of the Mapuche are actually a great example of indigenous people who have never been subjected to any foreign power, and they're very proud of it. We could see it from Juana. She was very, very proud of it, and it's true. And we also had Pepe going over to Colombia. There was this international mission where they were monitoring this demobilization process, and he was issued a press release after the mission. And there's a video also. Hopefully, we will be showing it at some point. Yeah, not today, unfortunately. Again, if you want to know more about these campaigns, there's also some links in LASK on the website. And hopefully we'll have our own website soon. And that's it, basically. If you have any questions about Colombia or any of the issues we've been talking about.
The question time. You got any questions or comments?
I only got in, so I don't really want to derail it. I don't know if you're from South America, so I'd just like to know what you think about Hugo Chavez and the Bolivian Revolution. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I'm sorry to hear on that. Not much really. Yes, just to be honest, as I was saying, in the myriad of leaders from the left in South America, he's the only one that seems to be moving to the left in some way or another. Though still, I think, far from revolutionary. But he's probably the only leader who openly talks of socialism now, a number of things. But what has happened with Chavez is an interesting process, because when he launched, he came with all these new ideas that were around at the time. Chavez didn't come to power back in 1998 with any new idea. All he talked about was participatory democracy and about grassroots participation, a number of grand ideas that were all around posed by the people in different movements of South America. What's remarkable is that Venezuela was not much going on at the time, so it all came as very revolutionary. But still, you have to understand again that many of the reformist leaders in South America would sound revolutionary only in the face of the very strong class conflict in South American society. For instance, take again Haiti, Aristide. If you take the discourse of Aristide, it was completely mild. Schools, better wages. But in a society like Haiti, where the poor are absolutely accustomed to be the underdogs, not to have a voice, not to have a say, it sounded revolutionary in that context. Again, you have to put Chavez again, back in 1998, Venezuelan society, it sounded more revolutionary than it really was. Then came the Constitutional Assembly. I'm all messed up with the years now. But it was different that around the time, 1998 to 2000, the Constitutional Assembly, So, it comes supposedly with a new spirit of country, a new spirit of state, and blah, blah, blah.
But the interesting thing in Venezuela is that with his rhetoric, he's been able to create in one way or another some expectations among the people on the grassroots, you know? So basically what you have now is a sort of social movement that has been created from scratch, you know, over the last years. How autonomous it is, it varies out from place to place. In some places they've been quite independent, in other places they're just a branch of state, you know, the Bolivarian circles and all that. But what I think, if you ask me personally, I think there's been a space open for people to come and intervene and have a sort of a say. But I don't think that will come from the top down. I don't think that will come from the government, you know. And no matter how much you can move to the left, reforms of the state have improved in Latin America since the Allende's time. They can reach only to some limit, you know. If the people are going to be willing to break that limit and take all the speech of direct democracy and workers' conference, a number of things he's talking about, you know, to its extreme and logic circumstances, it's going to mean a radical change, even with the Chavista project, you know. But up to now, as it's standing, you know, there is a situation going on, but there's not really an independent voice trying to make that case better. So still what you have is a leader from mere populism back in 98, has moved to talk about socialism and about a number of things, say that this year he's going to develop his ideas on the socialism for the 21st century, and he's going to drive the main ideas from the Bible, Marx and Lenin. What will come out of that, we don't know. You know, but I mean, you can't figure out. But yeah, of course, it's coming from, it's taking a discourse that has been prevalent in South America, trying to channel it through state reform, and that's an uneasy combination. And a lot can happen in the future. Again, you have to see as well the reaction of the middle classes against what's going on with Chavez. You know, Venezuela would say it's the seminal example of the oligarchic society of South America. You know, the rich and the poor are the poor. And when that logic is questioned, in one way or another, you know, there's hysteria. There's absolute hysteria. Say, for instance, as Philip Allende, if you watch...
I can put another couple of people in.
Oh, you have a couple of people in?
Yeah.
I'll leave it there, I suppose. It's answer anyway. Sorry for the tendency we have in Latin America.
I'll take a couple of questions.
Well, I'll try to do my best because I'm also South American and English is not my mother tongue as a matter of fact. But I wanted to make my point as regards that, as Brenda, that's your name, Brenda.
Yeah.
But Brenda said that I think that the revolution in Latin America, I think that there's a revolution or a revolutionary movement going on in Latin America, and I think that it's happening within the bottom, like what would be the grassroots, that's the word you used, like the people and not the leaders. And this is a confusion, like this is an anarchist gathering as far as I'm concerned. And this is a problem in Latin America. We're always looking forward to, I mean, we are always following a leader. As regards my country, that is Argentina, there are two unique things as far as I'm concerned. I'm a poet, not a politician or somebody specializing in politics. But there are two things, two movements that were started by the people and that I consider they are natural-born anarchist movements. But they are not aware of the fact that they are anarchists. That is the Movimiento Piquetero, and when both of them, that's also important to say, were started by women. And were started before the crisis in Argentina, before 2001, both of them. That was Movimiento Piquetero, the Piquet, that were started in Cutralco, and during this mild democracy, the one following one of these kind of socialist leaders or somebody who presented, introduced himself as a leader at the very beginning, that was Carlos Menem, who was a dictator, or a mild dictator, because that's another problem. We don't really have democracies in South America. We think we have because we go and vote, but that's not democracy. Everybody knows that. I mean, so it goes without saying that democracy is much more than that. And the other movement that is important to say, the takeover of factories. Factories being taken over by the workers. And the first factory that was taken over in Argentina was a textile factory run by women. Most of the employees were women. That was Brookman. And these two things were carried out without leaders, without a party supporting them. Then the trust, especially the Trotskyists, went there and took over, like ideologically speaking, but at the very beginning, and still today, this was absolutely done by people. Which brings me back to the thing that anarchism is a way of being, and probably it's a natural way of being, like it goes naturally, we tend naturally to that. So that's my point about being careful about the leaders, especially in Latin America.
Again, maybe I will make a comment on or raise the issue on the Mexico, you mentioned of the Mexico, Oaxaca and other things. It seems next week in the Amnesty branch on the Mexico from Campuchia branch, so we'll be meeting Mexican ambassador here in Dublin. Last year there was also a visit there, and it was always the normal way of diplomatic protocol that nothing is happening in Mexico, and Mexico is a tourist country, it's a peaceful nation. But looking at the incident in the left way, non-business way, you see a lot of problems happening in the so-called Democratic Republic of Mexico. I don't really know what the central government of Mexico, we are coming from Latin American angle, so it's really doing in order to solve the problem in the southern part, but in the Oaxaca area, Chiapas, because it seems the post 2005 was lesser compared with 2006. And this January this year, a lot of things have happened in the Mexico.
Well, I think 2006 was a key year because the presidential elections were held. There is a period of six years for every presidential period, and people had great expectations and faith on the electoral system. They truly believed that by voting they could change the macroeconomic policies, but what it happened otherwise, and that kind of generated all these movements. And also, if you slowly start leaving people without resources, people have to try and manage themselves and get them sorted by themselves. So it was a combination of these two. 2006 was also the year where the Zapatistas came on the public light again, and even if we didn't hear much about them for years, they still have a word to say, and that was the sixth declaration of the Lacandon Jungle, which was a call to gather a network and start building this national project of struggle.
So is there any some kind of here in Ireland, any some kind of move to start organizing some kind of demonstration? I believe so much in the active politics, active campaign. You see, one thing is that we talk and talk and talk, reading room, it all ends here.
Yeah.
But being an active now is really, I think, since we are, according to philosophers, we are all political animals. You see, so be whatever. Anarchists, socialists, or whatever, as far as we did. So what movement are we, what are we doing now to end this impunity? Because it is going on. It is getting worse and worse, as I said, in Mexico. And you know, the Mexico government is so powerful with the length of USA and other things and Europe. So are we organizing anything like demonstration?
Well, we have a Solidarity Dublin Zapatista group, but
but
you know, you do what you can with the resources you have sometimes, and there's been pickets at the embassy, but to be honest, during the winter, nobody wants to go at the Mexican embassy. Or when we tried to gather signatures and it was raining, for instance, or You know, we try to, and we have a great support, for instance, now from Chambre-Esprit, the local. We gather there at least, we have a place to go and meet sometimes. So you are actually all invited to come on Thursdays.
Yeah.
Not actually next Thursdays, because we are actually doing some screenings at the, in last about, not Mexico, but Latin American issues. The last film is next Thursday at 7:30 p.m. It's the Fourth World War. And you are all invited to
is
come.
Yes.
And actually, some women, now that we're talking about women, because I think it's the International Day of Women. And how important
March
women.
On March the 8th.
On March the 8th.
Uh-huh.
And how important women have been in all Latin libertarian movements, and some women from Africa are going to come over and talk to us that day too. So if you would like to come, you're all invited. Be sure to be early, because I think. If they come and it's quite small space and so on stage.
And
it hurt lunch.
And the
it's
5 Marion Row.
5 Marion Row.
5 Marion Row. It's me or Stephen Green, if anyone wants to go.
Okay, we run out of time. It seems as good a note as anything to end on, I think, there.
This podcast was recorded at the second Dublin Anarchist Book Fair, the 3rd of March 2007. The title of this session was The Rise of the Left in South America, and there were three speakers on different aspects of that. This is a podcast from the Worker Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie.